my 5-year goal is to replace my Air Force captain income at the time with the cash flow from my real estate portfolio. And then we got to, I think, 13 months into real estate investing, and we had reached that goal. And I was like, oh shit, like my goals were a little too low here. I didn't really aim high enough.
Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast.
Stand back while I celebrate freedom.
The show where we help you achieve financial independence with the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps from guests who've already earned their freedom.
The flags of freedom fly.
Choose to do what you want.
What you want.
With who you want.
With who you want.
When you want.
When you want.
With another episode today. Now, here's your host, Brian Lubin.
Blake Daly. What's up, buddy?
What's up, man? How are you?
Doing good, man. Doing good. We're going to have a good conversation here. You feeling energized? You feeling hospitable over here?
I'm feeling great, man. I'm always keeping my gratitude higher than my expectations, so I'm ready to go.
Let's rock, man. This is going to be a great episode. I'm excited to dive into who you are, what you do, and then dissect it. As I was telling you before the show, in the beginning, we go ahead and get the introductions out of the way. So this is your opportunity to say who you are, what the heck you do, what's the portfolio today, what's the cash flow, whatever numbers that you want to share. The more, the better. People love them on Action Academy. And then we're going to dissect a couple of topics and a couple of ways that you've built your portfolio for people that are in the hunt. So who is Blake Daly and why should they stick with us for the next 30 to 60 minutes?
Oh man, tall task. Started out active duty. So working a decently high paying job, the best benefits in the world, like socialism done perfectly as a military officer. And much like a lot of your audience, like I knew that I just didn't want that to be the full path for me. Stay in for 20 years. Like all the old guys, like the sergeants, you got to stay in for 20 because retirement is the best thing ever. And it's, dude, I could live a much bigger, fulfilled life. Like with, and I had these bigger goals. Got into real estate investing. Like that was my way. And I knew that I had a 5-year Air Force commitment after I graduated from the Air Force Academy. So like my 5-year goal is to replace my Air Force captain income at the time with the cash flow from my real estate portfolio. And then we got to, I think, 13 months into real estate investing, and we had reached that goal. And I was like, oh shit, like my goals were a little too low here. I didn't really aim high enough. So like, oops. I had to reset everything. So that first 13 months had been doing, I was down in Panama City in Florida. They just got hit with a hurricane. So a perfect place to get started and do creative deals, do big rehabs, create a lot of value in the properties that I was buying. And I was doing Burr B&Bs. So I was doing the Burr strategy, turning them into short-term rentals. And that's what got my cash flow up really fast. Did a few long-term rentals as well, a couple flips, like creative finance, seller financing, lease options, partnerships, private money, hard money, like everything I could do because I didn't have money. I was trying to build up my own war chest to go buy bigger deals. So at that like year point when my cash flow exceeded my W-2, I was like, I got to do something bigger here. I was like, commercial multifamily sounds cool because I see all the inefficiencies of having a residential portfolio with all my units spread out. So I'm going to do that. All the units are one place. So I got into that, syndicated an apartment complex, learned the commercial side, how to raise money, how to analyze deals, how to talk to brokers, how to find the deals in the first place. And it took 10 months. I was struggling, grinding away, and finally closed the first deal. And this was about the time that all the stimulus money was coming into the market. Big institutions, hedge funds, private equity were buying multifamily to hedge against inflation. Rates were at all-time lows. It was like super competitive. Cap rates were getting compressed. I was like, this multifamily, the juice isn't really worth the squeeze anymore. So what do I pivot to next? I know short-term rentals really well. Been self-managed, operated those, did everything myself. So I really understood how to operate Airbnbs profitably. And now I knew commercial real estate with the syndicating the apartment complex. So let's go look for some hotels that we can maybe either turn into multifamily or just operate better as like these hybrid, like little boutique hotels that are, put them up on Airbnb, renovate them, really make them really nice and focus on all the things that people want when they stay in an Airbnb. And I found that first one. It was an 8 units and I had 8 STRs at the time. So like, very easy to make that jump in my mind. Like I'm doubling with one purchase. I'm not buying a 100-unit Marriott and trying to figure that out. Like I've got 8 units all on one site. Laundry's all there. All my cleaning supplies, all the cleaners. That's got to be simpler. And the numbers turned out great. And then that just snowballed into buy in 5 boutique hotels in that first year, build up that business, got it up to $3 million a year in revenue, and then sold it and then rolled into the bigger 130 unit boutique hotel that just closed on in December to lock in the 80% bonus depreciation. But we might get back to 100%, which would be nice. So we're waiting to file our taxes now. But yeah, that's what I'm doing. So just rolled the successes forward into bigger boutique hotels. And that's my focus, is the commercial short-term rental game.
But Blake, I'm confused. So you started with short-term rentals, but then you pivoted to multifamily, but then you pivoted to hospitality. Isn't that shiny object syndrome? Isn't that what we're supposed to stay away from?
They tell you not to do. Yeah, you shouldn't be switching strategy. You just got to keep your head down and keep grinding and plow through it. No, I think it's like there's definitely a difference between jumping from one asset to the next and making like a strategic pivot, knowing like what your goal is and where you want to get to, and knowing that you're going up and to the right, but it's not going to be a straight line, right? You might squiggle and, you know, you might take 2 steps backwards to take 4 steps forward, because you're going to go through a learning curve. Whenever you switch an asset class, you're going to have this just absorption period, right? Having more conversations like this, like learning what you don't know. But I don't think it's not all bad, right? I wasn't going from flipping homes.
Yeah, but that's the game.
You got to cut your teeth. I wasn't going from flipping and then doing a commercial multifamily and then doing an STR and then doing a long-term rental. Like all of it was like very strategic, and then I knew I wanted to go bigger because of where I had met my threshold of what I could do in a day, right? Self-managing 11 or 12 rentals that it was all me working a full-time job. We're rebuilding an Air Force base at the time. It was pretty involved. And because it was after the hurricane there. So I could only do so much in a day. He's taking a change of clothes with me to go meet sellers after to work to talk about negotiating their deal to try to buy it at a discount. So I'd seen what doing all that different stuff looks like. But I think as long as you have the end goal in mind, knowing that it's not going to be a linear path, you leverage the skill sets and the experiences that you get along the way to get you to that end goal even faster. If you just stay on the same path, you might trudge through a swamp for the next 10, 20, 30 deals that it takes to get you there. But if you can pivot and get one bigger deal with 30 units, like you just got there on one leap.
Mm-hmm. So I love it, because this is what we teach all the time in our Group Action Academy and on this show, is we teach about beginning with clarity, beginning with the end in mind. So you know where you're heading, and then the how in between is almost the simpler part. We won't call it easier, but that's the simpler part, because there's so much variability there. And the reason that people have analysis paralysis is because they are scared to pick something, because they assume that thing that they pick is what they have to stay with. Because that's what they get drilled into, is you pick this and you're there for 20 years. Otherwise, it's shiny object syndrome. But I tell people, I'm like, dude, it's like a food court at a mall. Go try the free samples. And I think a really important point to highlight is you executed your transactions. I only call it shiny object syndrome when you're underwriting multifamily and then you stop before you get a deal because it's difficult. And then you go into underwriting short-term rentals and then you stop because it's difficult. Instead, what you did is you put tools in your tool belt. Each transaction, you did a flip, you did a BRRRR, you did some short-term rentals, you did an apartment complex, you raised the private capital to where at the end, you were able to try all the free samples around the food court. And you said, you know what? Damn, I really like the chicken. I'm going to go sit over here. I'm going to have a meal. And I wish more people, like your story just perfectly personifies that. And it's really cool that you did it that way. And it's just so interesting, all these different skill sets and all these different things that we pick up along the journey. I'm curious, across all of these different pieces and different puzzles that you were solving, what were some of the ones that were the stickiest to pick up? Was it the raising private capital? Was it the asset management? Was it the negotiation? Which skill sets were the stickiest for you to pick up?
Yeah, I think for me personally, it was probably the capital raising. Because like when I started out, I bought my first property at 22, used a VA loan, and was also writing direct to seller, like writing direct mail, sending them to the sellers, like handwritten addresses and everything, picked up some deals quickly. But at 22 years old, I didn't know a whole lot about real estate, especially like running a real estate business or calculating and explaining the internal rate of return, the IRR, or even the average annual return, which is a more simpler metric. But like, how do you explain those to investors when you're looking at a dealer? Okay, I'm willing to risk my money in this, but you got to have an additional
layer of confidence.
And have a check and balance when you're going to raise additional capital from other people. So I think being younger when I was raising capital, I think there was a lack of confidence. And also, like, how do you get in those circles? Because you really don't get very far in your professional career. You don't go to as many conferences by that point yet. Like, your network just isn't as large. So like, how do you get in front of those people? And a lot of it can be like things like this: Facebook groups, podcasts, go to actual real estate conferences and just go to local real estate meetups. Those are probably the easiest things you could ever do. Take an hour on a Tuesday night and just go meet people. So that's what I spent probably a year and a half really focusing on, was just building that network, building up the confidence to talk to people, and just getting the repetitions of presenting an opportunity and not asking for money. That was a big one. So I think I had the biggest hurdle with actually getting people to trust me, and also feeling like I was worthy enough to raise capital, like getting past the imposter syndrome of, hey, I'm really confident in this deal. Like, we will make money. And then taking that idea in my own head and presenting it to somebody is like, all right, now presenting it as an opportunity. We'll both make money on this thing. You've got your protections. You're an equity owner and it's backed by the asset, and just figuring out what different people, like, just through objections, you learn so much of people telling you no. Mm-hmm. Just repeated failure, you learn so much of, like, all right, that didn't work. Let me tweak this point or this part when I'm talking to an investor this time. And just, you have to get the rep. So if you're feeling like you're stuck raising capital, or people aren't resonating with you, or you're just not any good at it, it's probably because you haven't done it enough. Like, I've been through so many uncomfortable conversations now that picking up the phone just to talk real estate, which is what I love talking about anyway, is, I guess, not quite easy, but much easier than it ever was before when I was first starting.
Mm-hmm. What's your advice on building confidence?
Dude, reps. Like, you have to get in repetitions. If I told you, you got to go catch a ball from Tom Brady to win the Super Bowl in the back of the end zone over another 6'3" defensive back, how would you do that just without the practice, right? Without knowing your route tree, without knowing where you're going to be, and without knowing the timing of the route? You get that through repetitions. So that's a football analogy, because I was a football guy. But you have to get repetitions. You have to go through the muck. You have to get told no. You have to fail and fall on your face a couple times to build the resilience, because that's what business is. Like, anybody that talks about a super easy business journey, like they just hit all green lights, full of shit, or lying, or got there by fraud or something like that. Like, building a business is as tough as going through a really hard grinding season. I don't know if you're a football fan at all, but the Chiefs this year, everybody was hating all year long. Oh, they're not the team they once were. Turned it up in the playoffs, won the Super Bowl again. That is a story of
the brand new receiving core.
Exactly. A whole new team. So that is, I think, what business is a lot of the times. And looking back, you'd be like, oh, the Chiefs were so good. You know what I mean? They're a dynasty. But you don't remember back to that season, all the struggles they went through to get to that, holding up the trophy at the end of the season. I think it's a lot of that.
Yeah. I wish people, if they were to take one core theme away from listening to this podcast, because people that listen to this show listen to a lot of the shows that we do every single day. And if there's one core theme that I really want people to take away, it's that the people that are on the mountaintop that they look up to, you're not that much smarter than the average person. And I wish people would understand that, because they think that there's some pedestal that you were born on, some silver spoon that was in your mouth. But the reality of the situation was, you were just someone that was dumb enough to take massive levels of action and then learn from it. And we talk about passionate income, we talk about passive income, and you're not going to be passionate about anything until you put the reps in to get good at it. So instead of waiting for the confidence to take action, it's the taking of the action that yields the confidence. And
you're chasing in the beginning to be passive often doesn't start passive. So just like, understand that's the journey that you go through. Like, you work your ass off to earn passive income.
Correct. And then when it's passive, it's air quotes passive. Yeah. And then that all depends on the quality of your management and your leadership, because then it's a team. And that's why you have bingo. So that's why you have a lot of investors that listen to the show that are millionaires, multimillionaires. Some of them are worth 6 to 8 million, but they still haven't built the business. They still have the investor hat on and not the business owner hat on. I've gotten my ass kicked too. Whereas that's why I learned, because they say, hey man, like, I'm at 20 now, but if I would have put my business owner hat on sooner, and learn systems and processes and delegation and going from I do it to we do it to they do it. And I would have done that sooner. I would have exploded. And that's why we're able to do is taking that advice.
Yeah, as you climb up, you just get a different set of problems and issues that you're working through. I was listening to your podcast like a couple of weeks ago, and I know one thing you're going through right now is like optimizing your schedule and really outlining in your day what you're working on and when and protecting your time. And I'm doing the same thing because at our level of trying to become better leaders, better managers of our teams that are really doing the day-to-day of the businesses, you have these little like hands that reach up and want to pull you back down into the business. And these are your team members, right? So you're not trying to slap them away, but you're trying to build confidence in them so that you can run your business more effectively and focus on the vision, focus on the revenue sources, focusing on making sure their jobs stay safe, right? Because you're not going to go miss something by getting pulled into the business. You miss a big opportunity, your competitor gets over you, you lose a deal, like the stuff that can make a big impact on your business. So it's like the problems just shift. And yes, you can be passive, but more so in a sense that now you're a business owner. You've got people to manage. The more systems and processes you put in place and continue to delegate and elevate yourself, that's where you get true freedom. Mm. In each phase, it's like stair steps. Of you hit a bottleneck of now your time's being spent again. Like you're using all your working hours doing a different set of problems, right? It's no longer finding deals and managing the deals and all that kind of stuff. It's now managing the people who are doing those things. And then you get past that level and then you just get different sets of problems as you grow. You just gotta.
Yeah. I read a friend of mine had a really good quote. He goes, optimize, then maximize. And so first you optimize, and then that's when you build the SOPs, you build the systems. And then all of a sudden you have all your time back. And then you're like, okay, now what the hell do I do? Because now everyone's optimized. And now you maximize. Now you figure out your 2 to 3 things that you do best that really drive the ball home and make it rain. And you maximize those things and you pour the gasoline on the fire. So there's a book by Trey Taylor called A CEO Only Does 3 Things. And that's essentially set the vision for the company, hire and attract and retain top talent, and make sure that there's enough money to keep everyone paid. Like, that's it. Those are the 3 things that you're supposed to do. Yeah. And so now I'm like, okay, cool. Then what do we do to bring home the bacon? But let's pivot for a second to your acquisition strategy, because you hit on an excellent point that I really love. In Action Academy, we don't talk too much on short-term rentals because, capital B, because I don't find them to be very scalable. We've had some people that are very prevalent in the short-term rental space. Michael Olifante was on here, crushes it with short-term rentals. And they do it a very traditional way, the debt snowball way that you were doing in the beginning, where you maybe do a burr and B, basically, where you get a property, then use the profits from that to buy the second, to buy the third, to buy the fourth, act with active income in traditional debt products. But I never found them to be that scalable, because for me, I'm like, how do I come in? I can buy an 80 unit in one deal and just do one deal a year instead of doing, 80 flips. And I'm like, that doesn't apply to short-term rentals. So you have very specific thoughts about scaling short-term rentals, which is what led you into hospitality. Can you please share that?
Yeah, I think it's easier to buy. So what I do is boutique hotels, and I would attest that it is easier to buy one boutique hotel than a handful or an equal amount of short-term rentals, right? Because you're going to do, say, a 20-unit boutique hotel. Instead of going out and doing 20 transactions, you're furnishing 20 different houses. You're going to have probably 20 different themes. At a hotel, all your units are right there. You do one transaction, you get one bank loan, you raise capital one time. Hopefully, if you're doing it one investor, if you can do that, like we did on our first deals, we just had one or two investors on the first hotel deals, very streamlined. And then your units are smaller. Your design is much more straightforward. Like, you're buying all the same big pieces, but maybe embellishing different splash walls, different accent colors, things like that to give them their individual feel. But it's not 20 individual designs. It's one design on the whole building. And you're doing one transaction is the biggest thing. And then because of that, you have more revenue with that one purchase. And from the beginning, you can hire your team like you're just talking about and get yourself out of the day-to-day management and have that business run itself to where you can focus on, like you're saying, making the bacon, focus on your revenue management, on your marketing, on your bookings, and like your guest reviews, while your team services the guests, messages the guests, does all that. So I haven't messaged a guest in 3 years because my team is in place and we started buying these boutique hotels. So I think that is what you get when you talk about the scale, is it's really hard to buy individual Airbnbs and get to that same level, because you never quite get past the point where you're the one doing everything and wearing all the different hats. But if you can take a big leap by 20 units at one time, then you're out of it from the moment that that property is purchased and live and producing revenue.
Mm-hmm. Let's go through really quickly the buy side, then the raise side, because those are going to be the two bottlenecks for people. So let's go through, what's a typical structure that you use when you're financing these deals? And then we'll go into debt raises versus equity raises on the back end. So let's first start with the acquisition side for these boutique hotels.
On the acquisition side, I will say, like, much as you're doing a lot of deals, it completely depends on the deal itself. So mm-hmm. The most common that I've done has been equity raises, where it'll be either like a 60-40 on the most recent deal, or a 70-30, like we've done some of the past deals, or done like a 33-66. And what that is like the GP-LP split. So like a 70-30, LPs get 70% of the deal. GPs, the general partners, you in this scenario being the sponsor, the one running the deal, gets the other 30 for putting it all together. So that's how we usually structure them. And then either a preferred return or not. So like this most recent deal, maybe we could use that one as an example, was a 60-40 LP GP split. So GP's got 40% with a 7% preferred return to the investors. So they get paid up front. So you raise all that equity. This was a $3.55 million raise to get closed. So we raised the $3.5 million and from the investors, and then the GPs put money in as well towards that. So that was a 60-40 split, and that's your equity raise. And then on the debt side, just like it'd just be a big BRRRR B&B if you're doing one of these. So you would get the property, say you're buying it at 600, it's going to be worth $1 million, but you need to put $200,000 into it to get it up to that level. So you'd raise the down payment for the purchase price plus the $200,000 for repairs. Then once you get it up to be worth $1 million, then you refinance, pay everybody back. And those are usually 8-12% annualized interest. And you would just pay them off. It's private money. And then you own the asset outright afterwards. So those are the two ways that I've structured the deals. Just depends on the quality of the deal you get, the length of time that you have to do the deal. Sometimes maybe you have a 2-year balloon on seller financing and you have to get the equity out of it quick to get that balloon paid off. But if you get fresh financing with a commercial loan with a 10-year term, you can afford to do a longer value add phase, maximize the value, get it stabilized, refinance to get all the money back to investors, and then just hold for cash flow, keep everybody happy. Because that's another great thing about the hotel deals is they have great cash flow.
Mm-hmm, because it's the most variable cash flow that you can, because you have that direct tight control, like nightly, on create and be able to, that's very elastic.
Every single night, you're like, hey, we want to make some more money on these weekends. All right, let's potentially push out some marketing, or we see the demand going up. We're going to raise our rates, and we're making more for every unit that books after that. Yeah, the revenue management side of it is awesome, because as opposed to multifamily, you're changing your rates only when the lease is up and somebody moves out. So when you have so much control over the revenue you can earn, it's, yeah, no wonder we're 2-3x-ing the revenue in these hotels we're buying. It's like the past owners weren't doing any of that. No marketing. They weren't on the OTAs like Airbnb and Booking and Expedia. A lot of times if you get the right deal, it's an easy value add play to really increase the revenue. And the coolest thing about it is it's a business. So you're valued or by your income. So you're
by your NOI. Income. Yeah.
As you drive the NOI up, you're driving the value up. So it's like you can create massive equity jumps in these assets too.
This is more of a personal question, and I'm in the red zone here. So I mostly understand it, but I'm just about to punch the ball into the goal line here. What is the difference between a joint venture and a syndication? And then what are the advantages, the pros and cons of each? Like, why would you do a joint venture over a syndication, or a syndication over a joint venture?
Yeah, completely different structure. So your joint venture is like you have something and another party has something. You guys form a partnership and bring each piece of that puzzle to execute the business strategy. So maybe it's you bring the deal, the other party has all the capital that you need, and you guys JV on that deal and split the equity however you see fit. Even that could be a 70-30 split.
Correct.
Or it's just all in your negotiation. So you can make it a straight 50-50 joint venture. You provide the deal, they provide the capital. Very simple to structure deals like that. Simple JV agreement, your operating agreement for that entity, and then you go execute. So a syndication is a lot different. So this is where you technically get into the SEC realm. You're doing an exemption to do a public offering. You're usually dealing with a 506B raise, which is 506B for buddy, which is your friends and family. You cannot advertise.
Sophisticated.
Sophisticated investors. And you can bring up to 35 non-accredited, which means that people don't have to be millionaires or don't have to make $200,000 a year. So many more of the people you probably know if you're just starting out doing your first raise. So that's why a lot of people elect to go with the 506B or the 506C is accredited only investors. You can only bring in accredited investors, but you can advertise. So a lot of the bigger investors that are have funds, I think Brandon Turner with Open Door Capital and, and Pineda, these guys doing big syndications, they do 506Cs because they can advertise to their large audiences and people know them. So those are the two routes you can go with it. That syndication is you're raising money and you're offering chunk of the ownership to the investors who are limited partners, meaning they don't have voting rights. They don't manage the asset. You do that as the general partner. And that was what I was talking about earlier with the GPLP split. So it's just a different structure there. Like syndication, you're going to need a syndication attorney to structure that raise. You're going to have a subscription agreement, your operating agreement. It's going to be more costly, but usually the syndications are for when you bring in more investors to get the deal done. The joint venture would be like, all right, we got one or two people we could go knock this thing down with. We'll just do a JV because it's simpler.
Yeah. Is there a max amount that you would bring to a JV table? Is it like 3 to 5? And then after that, it'd be more beneficial to do a syndication raise?
Generally, yeah. It's like that gray area to where if you get too many partners, like to be a partner, you have to have an active role, right?
Correct.
If you don't have an active role and you had 6, 7, 8, 9 partners, and three of them are just like passive, not doing anything, then you're like, you get into that realm of you're probably offering a security and you need to go the syndication route, do the exemption to the public offering, which is your Reg D offering, which 506C and 506B fall under, and then you're in the clear. So syndications are typically for the situations you're bringing in more investors. Because a lot of, like my first ever Botica Pub deal was a Burr B&B. So straight debt raised, I don't know, 600 or 650,000. Refinanced it, paid them all back plus interest. And then the next four were partnerships. So we just have a total of 4 investors over 4 deals, like different investors on different deals. But it was super simple. Like it's partnership agreements, not syndication and 506B and 506C. So we kept it simpler because we had fewer, but much higher capital invested investors. And this most recent one, it was my biggest single raise yet, almost $4 million. And we knew we were going to, or I had a very good feeling anyway that I was going to need to bring in more investors. So I went the syndication route and brought in, I think 14 maybe total investors, but that's definitely too much to be a partnership.
Okay. So can you rip apart an idea I have and let me know? Okay, cool. So the way that I view this, because I have friends that do all of this, right? I have friends that have, I'm friends with Brandon. I just did his podcast and he's got thousands of people on his investor list. I'm friends with Ryan. He's got thousands of people on his investing list. It seems fucking terrible to me. It's almost like
investor relations for that.
It's yeah you immediately
they have a whole enterprise around
correct, and it just looks awful because you're the way I view it is I'm like, dude, that just seems like another job to me because now you're working for your investors, and so now it's just like you have like stress reintroduced to your life. So, anyways, and I could be wrong, and that's why I do this podcast and I ask these questions. So my idea is I, in 2025, I'm going to move into the international space. I want to do boutique hotels like you, which is why I'm interviewing you. You're the first of many here that are going to be boutique hotels. So congratulations, Blake
Start
Daly's number
trend,
one.
Baby.
Start of the trend. because I want to learn everything about it. Yeah, yes, sir. And five star rating and a review for the podcast and for his property on Yelp. So for me, I'm just like, in 2025, I would almost rather just do something to where I'm like, you know what? I've got $1 million in cash. I'm going to bring that in. I'm going to have 2 or 3 other people. One of them is going to be the best operator in this space, like the best boutique international hotel operator that I become friends with. I'm going to partner up with them and maybe 1 or 2 more people and just get this thing done quietly. Make it as simple as possible. Do a joint venture agreement. Have control of these assets and then build up the portfolio that way. Take down large deals. And then eventually down the road, when the team is built up and a little sturdier, then maybe we can go into the public offerings. But that's just how, for me, that's how I think that I wanted to start it. And if you could go back, is that something that you would still do like that way? Or do you think it'd be like, nah, dude, that's stupid. Keep your cash and just go ahead and just raise. Because I could do either. I could send an email right now and raise if I wanted to. But I don't.
Yeah. such
Does
a
that make sense
to be in. Yeah, in between a rock and a hard place, like it's a good decision, good direction either way. I personally would prefer fewer, larger investors. It's easier. It's more relational. If they have a question about it, they text you like, "Hey, Blake, how's operations doing?" You're like, "Oh, we did this. We hired a new person. He's on target. We're looking awesome. Hey, when are we going to go visit this thing together? Let's plan a trip."
That would be me. I would not be the operator in any of these deals.
But when you have a bunch of investors, it definitely, one, it ups the amount of work you have to do up front, right? Your filings, your investor portal, your reports, all this stuff, right? Like you have every subscription doc and operating agreement doc needs signed and filed and all this stuff. Then you got to do the K-1s and the tax filings and all this
stuff. To everyone.
Yeah, to every single investor. So your workload expands pretty quickly. So that's why like Brandon has a head of investor relations and people under them that probably a full accounting team that or finance team that does all this stuff internally. It's not Brandon out there doing the K-1s, and you don't want that to make you either. But it allows you, when you do raise money, it allows you to reach a lot more people and pull a much bigger amount of money if you wanted to turn this into more of an enterprise. Hey, let's go buy 2, 3, 4 boutique hotels this year. So that's what I'm focusing on. And in quarter two of this year, after I get separated from the Air Force and move to Tennessee and stabilize, is let's focus on the fund, because then I can reach more people and go buy more of these deals. Because I know if I'm out there finding deals, like my biggest limiting factor is finding or is having enough capital. Like I can find good deals all day long. Like I get them sent to my inbox every single week. I'm like, man, I wish I could take this down. It's a beautiful deal. It's in a great location. I love it. But I'm focused on this one and I don't have enough capital available. But if you're wanting simplicity, if you're wanting ease of entry and you have that kind of network or maybe personal cash yourself, then I would say keep it simple. Do the first one as a joint venture agreement. Test the waters, right? Find the right operator who you know is not going to be one of those hands that's grabbing you and pulling you down. No, dude, that's why I joint ventured with you. This is your problem. You figured it out. Like my problem was putting all the pieces together, make sure the ship stays its course kind of thing. Great. That's the position you want to be in. So you need to find the right pieces to put in together. So if I had to go back, I would probably have spent just as much time cultivating individual relationships with like higher net worth people rather than doing all the, I don't know, not that I don't want to have relationships with lower net worth people, but it's just more work to do it. Because on this specific deal, I had to do the due diligence, hire the team, because I'm the main operator too. So I had to do all this stuff, set up the marketing, get through closing, answer the lender questions, like really be there for the transaction. And it was raising money at the same time, taking investor calls. So like my schedule was crazy. And I was like, I am never raising money and closing a deal again. That's why May 24th
choose one.
It's going to be the fund first. We'll raise $10 million all at one time, and then we'll go allocate from the funds. Make your life as simple as possible, because you want to make sure like you're getting the right deals with the right people and not getting bogged down by the demand of closing one deal.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I just asked that from that perspective because I've just seen it so many different ways, and I'm just trying to figure out which one is best for me. To close out, we go back to two key levers that you just discussed, which is investor flow and then deal flow. So you said, okay, my bottleneck is I need more capital. I need more investors, but I have deals for days. Or you have someone like me where I'm like, dude, I've got 9 million investors, but I don't have any deals. So it's like peanut butter and jelly. So that would be a great partnership. Cough, maybe in the future. But anyways, right now, today, so how did you establish the deal flow? Because it's always a lack of capital or it's a lack of deal flow. So how did you establish the deal flow to where you are today, where you're saying, dude, I'm getting freaking things sent to me and I can't even take them down?
I think it's just the consistency and what I've been about the last couple of years. So if you tell everybody that you are looking for flips in the Nashville market, 3-bed, 2-bathroom houses, 1970 or newer, you have really clear criteria to where every time somebody finds a house like that in that market, they're going to think of you, then they're going to naturally send those deals to you. And because that's what's happening to me, and because boutique hotels is like more of a, I don't know what we call it, novel, not really novel, but there's not as many people doing it. It's more unique. Oh, when you think about boutique hotels, I want people to think about Blake. So it's, oh, I found a good deal. I don't know how to take it down. Or I'm an agent. I've got this deal. I don't know how to trade it. I don't have a buyer's list for this kind of thing. Like I want people to like, hey, who do I know that would buy this deal. And then somebody tags me in the Facebook post. That's actually how I found this deal in the Smokies. Was somebody posted a deal in one of the groups I'm in, and somebody tagged me and was like, hey, Blake, you need to look at this, because they knew I do hotels. So a lot of it comes through that and just networking, like my Instagram profile and awareness and what I do on social media is like trying to give value in the boutique hotel space and help people there, so that when people think boutique hotels, they equate it with me. Mm-hmm. Way. So that way, like whatever kind of help I could provide, helping people avoid mistakes that I've made, because that stuff makes me feel good. And then also like getting opportunities sent to me from people who might not even know me, but have built trust or credibility with what I put out there. And I don't know, the ecosystem, and it comes back. So I think a lot of it's like giving value and getting value back. And then just probably, I don't even know how many to count, thousands of broker calls, probably, of really telling them my criteria. They send me junk deals. I'm like, no, here's my criteria. They send me deals that are a little bit closer. I'm like, no, here's my criteria. And just staying on top of them, but like also building a relationship with them at the same time. So I want to know what they're all about. I want to know if they're a golfer or a duck hunter, or if they're a boater or whatever it is. We'll talk about that kind of stuff, because I want them to build the relationship with me. And when they get the opportunity, send it to me. So the sources are like far and wide. One is brokers, probably two is social media. Three is just like my network of friends and connections that know what I do. So those are the big three sources. And I think the more you put it out there of what you're looking for, and the more specific you can be with it, the more opportunities that just generally come your way.
Blake, there's no way it's that simple. There has to be a secret.
I think the secret is just thousands of reps of that over the last 3 years. Like, I've been in boutique hotels for 3+ years now, and everybody knows that I'm doing that. And I screen a ton of deals that come up on LoopNet, on Crexy, and all this stuff. But if you're not finding enough deals, you're probably not working hard enough. You're probably not getting on ListSource and pulling lists of all the hospitality assets in your market, whittling it down, clearing off the Marriotts and the Hiltons, because you're not going to buy those from some private equity guy anyway, and whittling down to maybe the 20 target deals in any given market. And then calling those owners, and then mailing those owners, and then mailing those owners again, and then starting relationships, starting conversations with them, finding what potential pain points that they might have, and then making your offers that way.
Or they're not making offers.
And to get deals, you got to make offers. Think of it as a big funnel. Like, you, if you're not getting in, like if you're not screening enough deals, or first of all, if you're not closing enough deals, it's because you aren't getting enough deals in the top of the funnel. So one, increase your lead flow, call more brokers, pull lists, send mailers, tell people what you're doing, go on podcasts and say, hey, send Blake a deal. So stuff like that. And then you got to screen, analyze, and offer. If you're not making offers, you're never going to get a deal. Even if you're, shoot, some of these boutique hotel deals are multi-million dollar deals, you might be off $500K, send the offer anyway. Like, you'd be surprised. The more offers you get, the more deals you will get.
We had a come to Jesus post in our group the other day where I posted and I said, hey, there's people in here that are really winning and they're taking down hotels. They're taking down, we got a guy that took down a freaking 12 unit and a 24 unit motel. One day, same day, two different transactions. Yeah, what are the odds of that? And that was his first real estate deal, two transactions, same day.
And two, so you hotels, got guys that are, no less.
Yeah, and so you got a baller, guys and girls that are crushing it, and you got guys and girls that aren't. And so it all comes back to, and some of them are listening to this. I say the same thing. I said the same thing on the thing. I'm like, if you have been in here a year and you haven't done a deal, you need to look in the mirror and ask yourself a simple question. How many deals am I analyzing per week? How many offers am I underwriting per week? And if you are taking the proper amount of action that you know you should be taking to yield that result, and it still isn't working, you need to change the asset class. I say, if you just take those three actions, you will change like the result, because you can't just keep doing what you're doing. You can't just keep calling two laundromat owners a week, or you can't just underwrite two deals a week, or talk to one broker per week. And you're like, dude, I've been doing this for a year. I can't find anything. There's nothing in my market. Bullshit. You're not doing the volume, the proper amount of volume that it takes. When I was in sales, every single sales rep that was in the same job as me, I was better than 5,000 of them, because I just made more calls. That is it.
Reps. Got in the reps. And through the reps, you get the learning. Through the learning, you get better. With that, you get more success. With
ridiculous.
The ratio goes up. So yeah, but nobody's going to make your dreams come true. You have to go get it. So if you're on that edge, go get it. Know that nobody's going to give you everything that you want. That's not how the world works. You got to go out there and take it. And a lot of times, like the hard truth that you don't want to admit, oh, it's an excuse. Oh, like me, I'm active duty. I work in a SAP program. Like it's top secret security clearance. I can't just not do that job, and I can't be accessing all my real estate and all my business stuff all the time. I could make that an excuse. Oh, I just had kids. Like that's an excuse. No, just look yourself in the mirror. You have to go out and make it happen. And if you're not as successful as you want to be, it's because you're not as good as you should be yet. It's because you haven't done as many reps as you need to yet. So start.
Which is controllable.
Which is very controllable. Yeah. Like the deals is the perfect thing. Screen more deals, analyze more deals, offer on more, and you will get more deals done. Same thing with investors. Talk to more investors, pitch them on the deals that you have. You will get more to commit. And those ratios goes up over time because you get better by doing these reps. Just like sports. Patrick Mahomes didn't throw his first pass the day before the Super Bowl. You got to put in the reps.
Bingo. So if people wanted to put in reps and find some deals for Blake Daly, and they want to do some deals with Blake Daly, where do they find you? Where do they find out more about you? And who are you looking for right now? How can we help?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to find me would go to Instagram, still answer my own DMs. I do not have a huge following. I got a small niche trying to make it bigger, trying to bring more awareness to it, that one boutique hotel can literally change your life. One short-term rental is going to make your life probably a little bit more convenient. Two or three might get you close to getting out of your job, but one boutique hotel will literally change your life with the scale that comes with it. But an exciting thing we're working on right now is the first ever boutique hotel con coming September 2024. At the actual boutique hotel that I just bought that has a wedding and event venue. So we're going to hold a boutique hotel conference at a boutique hotel so you can actually see it in person.
Damn.
I think that's super cool. I've never done an event before. I saw the one you just did at the end of the year. Went super great. So I'm trying to take notes and have a good first one. But yeah, boutiquehotelcon.com. You can get your on the...
Ooh, boy, got the domain.
Yep.
Got the domain official. Yep. And then what's your name? And then what's your name on Instagram?
Instagram is at Blake J Daily, and Daily is D-A-I-L-E-Y.
D-A-I-L-E-Y. You heard it here first. Blake J Daily on Instagram. And then what's the website one more time?
BoutiqueHotelCon.com.
Wonderful. Guys, you can find both in the show description. Blake, thank you so much for coming on, brother man.
Thanks, man. It was awesome to talk to you today.
It's Blake and Brian with the Action Academy Podcast. Go buy a boutique hotel, baby. See y'all.
Do it.
Okay. Hey, real quick, if you're still listening to today's episode, I'm assuming you got value from it, so I need your help specifically. My 2-year vision with this show is to help over 1 million people do what they want, when they want, with who they want, and I can only do that with your help. There are two main ways that a podcast grows. One is through ratings and reviews, and the other is word of mouth. If you could please leave me a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as well as send this to one or two friends that you think would get value from it, we can reach the people that we're looking to reach. Thanks in advance. Talk tomorrow.